welcome to episode 20 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Howdy-o.
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
Hello.
Proud sixth place participant of the most recent game night here in Melbourne, Owen Penn.
So proud.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. We'd like to talk today about our What Lies Ahead data pack competition. We've received an overwhelming number of entries, especially in the first only few hours that the competition went up on the internet. As we said in the original post, we were just going to talk about the winner, but we've got so many good entries that we thought we really should spend an episode talking about a few highlights before announcing a winner, because we think there's some really good content in here. So the first question is from Alejandro G. He asks, can older, more popular decks, even ones from as late as 2012-2013, remain competitive with the current card pool? How would this affect new players to the game who only have access to older data packs, and can they still be competitive against these current cards? Shilzy, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel like older decks from, you know, last season or the season before can still be very competitive. Like, in general, I feel like the core set is the strongest pack you can buy. It has the most wide, varied number of threads. It has the fundamentally most powerful cards. You know, all your end the run ice, your ice walls in Wayland, your snares in Jintekia, it has your account siphons in Criminal and your Desperado. You know, it doesn't give you a lot of depth, certainly, in each faction, but that's what the big boxes do. But there's still, like, Astro Scripts and Sand Sands and Bardic Labors. They really set the bar with core set, and they haven't really challenged it in terms of power level, whereas they have certainly introduced a lot of depth to the game, which just varies it up entirely, gives it a lot of crisp new replayability and helps people enjoy taking factions in new directions. But that doesn't change the fact that the older decks that were powerful are still powerful now. The fundamentals of the game haven't changed. You still make runs, you still value economy, you still access agendas, you still find scoring windows. That's how the game played. And so those old decks will be just as good now as they were previously. And in fact, I think in a lot of the ways, old decks might even have the kind of double bluff to them now. You introduce enough cards to the metagame, you introduce things like Grail, you introduce things like Swordsman as a popular card, or Eater, Keyhole, as a popular combination. And all of a sudden, the old tech works very, very differently.
Yeah, it's interesting when you now, if you now sit down with, say, a World Championship winning deck from 2 years ago, or even just a deck that did well at a tournament 18 months ago, you may not be playing against the same opponents in terms of decks. The metagame has shifted and varies now much more widely than it did in the first couple of years of the game. Now that we've got a big box for almost all of the factions, poor old NBN waiting out till last.
Man, it has Astro. I wouldn't call it poor.
Yeah, I think they're doing fine.
On a pretty good high. Almost yeah, as you'd be expected to print its big box slot.
Exactly. So, if you consider that, yeah, every faction now has a big box, there's a diversity of threats coming out of any ID in any faction. It's much more, a lot of the cards that initially weren't as powerful because they couldn't double up, particularly corp cards, they couldn't double up in the runner's mind as many other things, because you may have only had one or two upgrades in each faction, you may have only had one or two assets, you may have had a very limited number of hostile or aggressive assets. The range of threats that the corp could present to the runner was much smaller. Even within ice types, there may have only been a handful of destroyers, a handful of AP ice, only a certain number of barriers that are strength 4, for example. Whereas now you've got a proliferation of these things. There's a far wider array of things that every face down card in the corp's play area could be, which means that a lot of the cards that early on weren't very powerful because the runner pretty much knew exactly what they were, now they don't, and you can get away with bluffing a lot more. So that brings a lot more cards into the limelight as well, which is interesting.
Yeah, and like the metagame changes not just when new cards are introduced, but when runners are forced to change their style just because new threats become apparent. So, you know, even if you don't change anything about the game except change the value of swordsmen or change the value of sentry breakers by introducing something like Grails, we've moved from that stage where runners used to maybe face check with a Kuroda and a fairy to the point now where you either want to run with nothing or run with everything, you know, because if you run with a fairy, you could get hit by Galahad or a Merlin. You could just take 6 net damage to the face, and keel over. It's not like you're going to install a Deus Ex and then start running, because what if they just have the classic roto? So the fact that the runner has been forced to change it up quite a lot means that, you know, old strategies that aren't presenting that same threat are still going to benefit from the shape of the metagame.
Our next question comes from Benjamin O. One topic I'd like to hear in greater detail is about timing. That is to say, click compression on the runner's part and click taxation on the corpse part, and how either leads to opening scoring windows for either side. Owen, as a new player, has this concept come naturally to you, or have you had to sort of learn a bit more about it?
No, I've definitely had to learn a bit more about it. I've approached this from a Magic background, where card advantage is basically everything, and so translating that into the economy of Netrunner has been really difficult. In particular, the way that credits, cards, and clicks all relate to each other. Clicks, which could obviously refer to credits, cards, a combination of both, or runs. The way that these economies interact and the way that you value economies on the corp and the runner side has been a really interesting thing to manage. In particular with scoring windows, which took me the longest. Understanding when to recognize, when to take advantage of, and also when to generate scoring windows was a completely new concept that I had to develop coming from a game like Magic, which had nothing to do with that style of play. So yeah, these were all definitely new concepts and things that you have to learn to really understand the way that a game of Netrunner operates.
For me, click compression and click taxation, or if you want to sort of expand on what those terms mean, click compression, which is the runner trying to compress more into their clicks, is really the essence of what runners are trying to do. Most of the cards in a runner deck will either be about allowing you to get past the corporation's ice, so you've got icebreakers, things which find you icebreakers, or things which enhance your icebreakers, or they're about breaking the game's fundamental rules, which is that for each click you get one credit or one card or one run. So a lot of the runner cards will combine these things, so you might be getting a run and some credits like Dirty Laundry. You might be getting cards and credits like Professional Contacts. So click compression for runners is absolutely essential, and the cards that allow you to do this in the most efficient way, like gaining your 8 credits or net 5 off of daily casts, is extremely good, because all you're investing is one card, one click, and the 3 credits, and you're going to get back 8. That's far more efficient than clicking for credits 5 times. All of the runner's cards are basically about doing this thing and making your clicks more efficient. Even multi-access cards are an important example, because the click or the run event that you're spending to access HQ or R&D, if you're able to access multiple cards, you're making that far more efficient. And multi-access is another great example of click compression. Click taxation, on the other hand, is exactly what corps need to do to win, because corporations have to invest far more resources in an agenda to get it into their scoring zone than the runner does. In most instances, with some notable exceptions, like NAPD contract, the runner just has to access the agenda in order to steal it and add it to their score area, whereas the corporation has to invest a number of clicks and credits and the action to install in order to score it, which means that if the corporation is going to win that race, considering that the corporation's economy generating cards, or the cards that generate them credits, are quite comparable to the runner's, the corporation is going to have to either find a way to generate economy extraordinarily quickly or at a rate that's far higher than runners, which is very difficult to do, with a couple of notable exceptions like a sundew that's well, or multiple sundews well protected in RP. That's probably one of the only ways you can do it. They're either going to have to do that, or they're going to have to force the runner to waste clicks. And that's really the essential fundamental of most corp games, is making the runner make runs that, or luring the runner to make runs that don't hit agendas. So you can do that in a remote server by placing something there to lure them into the run and having ice in front of it that's wasting their credits along the way. Or by placing your ice in front of R&D and HQ, forcing them or luring them to run there with the promise of the agendas that are just sitting there waiting to be stolen, and making them spend heaps of credits on the way through each time to waste their credits, waste their clicks, and then open up those windows for you to score your own agendas. It's absolutely fundamental to co-op play.
The next question comes from Kevin D. He asks, in a tournament setting, how do you react when it's clear that the deck across the table from you is something you've never seen before? Now, Owen, as a relatively new player, this could be the case with almost every match you play. So do you find that it's been easy just for you to play conservatively, or how have you really just adapted?
Knowing the cards really helps. That's a huge deal. We could talk about a card being relatively unplayable, but if you get hit by it at the wrong time, you're still going to lose the game to it. I had this great game against a Blue Sun deck where I lost to a Janus. I had the full suite out. I was playing around everything that he could have, and then he flips a Janus. Like 15.
And you'd never seen the card before.
I'd never seen a Janus before. Had I seen a Janus before, I'm not sure I would have played around it, just because, you know, who does? But, you know, he got me with it. So I think in situations, you just have to be constantly thinking about what your opponent could potentially be playing and whether you can afford to invest the resources to play around it.
Do we think it always comes around to knowing the exact card pool, or does it really change your style of play when you don't know what your opponent is playing? Shilzy?
A trick I like to use quite a lot, because I do try and build a lot of like little rogue decks, or I do try and change things up quite a lot and try strategies that we haven't seen before or aren't necessarily popular and just really push the limits of the game. But at the core of all that, I think it's incredibly necessary to stick to the fundamentals. If you're not sticking to the fundamentals, it doesn't really matter what you're doing, you're just going to lose. Bearing that in mind, and bearing in mind that my opponent is very likely a rational human being, then I like to imagine how they built their deck, why they put it together, what was their motivation, what are they trying to get me with, is there some kind of gimmick that they just want to pull off and post about on Reddit. Like, those are little things that will pop up, and once you work out exactly why your opponent's playing that deck, usually it falls into place pretty quickly. But yeah, I like to make a lot of concession to AI breakers in my runner decks, just because I like to have access to servers. Doesn't even matter if they're playing even if they have a data mine or a universal connectivity fee or a Kitsune. I want to be able to not get hit by that gimmick just because it was an aspect of the card pool I wasn't remembering. So I think AI breakers are really important in that regard, and I try and fit at least one or two in most of my decks. Well, as a corp, this is why I value End the Run Ice so severely. If the runner is doing something gimmicky, if they're going for triple interface with Mass Installed, or if they're going for Underworld Contacts and Extra Link, well, it doesn't matter if my ice isn't Tracer, doesn't matter if they have Gingerbread or not, because it's a paper wall. You know, it ends the run. If they can't deal with that, I'm just going to crush them. That's just how it goes. That's the fundamentals of the game. Being rogue, being different, being unrecognizable is certainly an advantage, so long as you stick to those fundamentals. But by sticking to the fundamentals, you give your opponent the option, the opportunity to piece that back together. And at some point, they will work out what's going on. So I try and get in their headspace.
The next question is from Zachary H. He asks, to me, one deck type for runners that could be really, really fun is Ice Destruction. What's the best way to implement this, particularly with all of the new cards in Order and Chaos? Jesse, you mentioned that you were tinkering around with a deck of a similar vein.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've just been throwing together a bunch of random new decks, as I'm sure a lot of people have been doing with Order and Chaos. And one thing that I've been enjoying is an Edward Kim deck that I put together. It's got a standard Anarch Breaker Suite with Kuroda Mimic Yogg. I've also got a passport in there to give you some easy access and cheap, efficient access to code gates, a code gate breaker for central servers. And then you're just trying to hammer their centrals using the Forked, Knifed, and Spooned. I'm not playing as many Spooned as I am Forked and Knifed. I think I've got three Knifed, two Forked, one Spooned. Then you're playing those efficient breakers. You've got Eaters in there just in case there's a couple of ice you really want to murder that you can't do efficiently with your other breakers. You've got Wanton Destruction. And then you've got Gravedigger as well, which is a great way to gain some additional benefit. Not only are you trashing their ice with your parasites or your fork, knifed, and spooned, but you've also got this additional benefit accumulating from your counters on Gravedigger that you can use to just mill a few cards and then run archives or use your Hades shards. So yeah, there's a lot of options for ice destruction. It's always been a powerful thing for the runner to be able to do, undermining one of the really fundamental aspects of the corp's play and really placing pressure on them to dig for those extra ice when you're killing them. So yeah, good luck, Zach, with finding the best combination. I certainly haven't found something that I'm entirely happy with yet, but I'll be sure to let you know when I do.
Our next question is from Paul L. He says, there's a lot of information in this game. It would be great to hear your take on managing it, such as how to tell if someone's bluffing, how to play around cards, risk management, and getting a read on the meta. Liam, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of good little tricks that you can certainly get into the habit of, make managing that information much easier. So, for example, I like to reduce all of the ice that I'm likely to see over the course of a game just to a number, because it's much less details to remember. Another thing I like to do is remember which order my opponent installed their ice in, particularly while it's derezzed. Because looking back on the game state and then constructing those last few turns really is often central to how they installed that ice. Maybe they celebrity gifted and revealed something to you and then they played out that ice, or maybe you saw a Rotho on top of R&D and then they installed that two pieces of ice. Well, there's two pieces of ice you don't want to run now whilst you don't have Mimic, or whilst you don't have a Force of Nature or an Alias, who knows. But just remembering which order they play it in is so important for that.
Joss, I think it's important to note that when ICE was installed for reactionary purposes, for instance, if you know which ICE was installed before you showed them that you had a mimic versus the ICE they install after they know you have that mimic.
I think part of my playstyle and part of your playstyle too, Brian, I recognize this a lot out of you, is that you tend not to install your breakers until the very last second when you actually need them. And I think a lot of the time that's really good stuff. You know, you show them a Yog and they just won't install their Quandary or won't install their Enigma. But you know, you ask them to pay for that, you generate threat and ask them to keep you out of the server, then slam your Yog while they have those credits tied up. You know, there's a much bigger advantage there.
Yeah, that's a really great segue into something that we talked about quite a few episodes ago in one of our early episodes, which was managing hidden information and the fact that almost all of the information on the co-op side is hidden, but very little of the information on the runner side is hidden. So it's generally the only thing that's hidden is the runner's hand. So the runner can use that to their advantage to lull the corp into a false sense of security. And that's one of the most classic runner plays, is to hold those sure gambles so that the corp thinks you're a lot poorer and they think they've got a scoring window when in fact they don't. Or hold those icebreakers and seem frustrated and not be able to get through that ice, and then lay down your icebreaker when they play the agenda behind the ice. Those are all ways that the runner can abuse the small amounts of hidden information that they have to leverage an advantage.
I think particularly it comes to a card like Special Order. You very rarely, I think, want to Special Order on your last click when you are really just revealing to your opponent that I now have this breaker, and that gives them the information. I think you want to be able to, if you're going to Special Order for something, you don't want your opponent to know that you're going to be able to do that and then run with it in the same turn.
Yeah, if they know you have a mimic, I think a lot of the time as the corp, it's just not worth installing, unless you have other things like maybe Corporate Troubleshooter to back it up, unless you actually are trying to construct a game state where you do get them. Yeah, you know, maybe with a Merlin trashing that mimic, or maybe with a power shutdown, just to get that fairy.
That is a trade-off for the runner as well, because you're obviously potentially sacrificing some tempo. If you're installing your icebreaker the turn before you intend to make the run, then you've probably got more flexibility on that next turn. So it's not always a hard and fast rule that you wait until the very turn you're going to make a run, or the very turn you're going to strike to install your icebreakers, because you might need those other clicks on that turn to be drawing up cards if you're playing against a deck that's doing you damage above your 5-card maximum, or you might need those clicks to install other cards that you need that aren't icebreakers, such as interfaces or something like that, or to run multiple times.
Or just to pay for an enhanced login protocol, or pay to try and power through a Nisei Mark II tokens, or to try and access through an Ash, or God, there are so many reasons you need big turns. Shout out to Amped Up, like, clicks are gas. Clicks are so good.
The other thing Paul touches on is how to tell if someone's bluffing. And I think my personal philosophy in Netrunner is to call your opponent's bluff in the situations where it's not going to cost you too much in terms of resources and tempo. For instance, if you run your opponent's HQ on click one and they make a bit of a pained face as if they're worried you might steal an agenda, and you don't hit an agenda, maybe don't run three more times, because I know that I've done that to people in order to get them to waste clicks, and I know other people have done that as well. And for instance, I recently had a game where I was playing against Noise, and I had about 8 or 9 points of agendas in the bin and no Jackson. My opponent ran archives, I revealed a Viper, and I chose to sink no credits into the end the run subroutine. He chose not to, what he thought, waste his credits to meet that just to access nothing, because surely if I had agendas in there, I would have pumped it sure, like, as much as I could. That's the kind of bluff where you want to call it just on the off chance that there could be something in there. Would you guys agree that's the best way to go about things, or do cards like Mushin Notion really mix it up?
Mushin Notion's, I think, quite unique, just because there's no real good out for the runner. You know, it could be a Ronin and they cop that to the face, or it could be a Junebug and they don't have the Deus Ex and they just die. But I certainly think, just in general what you're saying there, Brian, doing things nonchalantly and then acting unsurprised when the runner treats it like a nonchalant action that's not worth anything. You know, that's exactly how a bluff's meant to work. I love just playing out 3-for-2 agendas in empty servers, making it look like a pad campaign or a daily business show, whatever. They expect me to res it. They think they know what it is, especially in NEH or Hasbiro either. You know, I'll leave NAPD contracts or fetal AIs out on the board forever because, you know, they thought it was a trap, or they think it's just the second Sansan and they can't res. Or, you know, there are lots of great cards that we just throw out into the board that the runner doesn't want to lose advantage by accessing. And I think that's a just, again, part of the sheer power of Desperado. God, I love Desperado. Being able to run and look at these servers and gain that credit at the same time. The cost is really just negated, so you do get to check around.
And that comes back to that. That comes back to click compression that we're talking about earlier. Desperado is number one example. Just shows you that you could have spent that click to just gain a credit, but instead you're getting a really vital, important piece of information, and you're forcing the corp to abandon a whole play style of, you know, playing horizontally and bluffing you out with remotes and trying to overwhelm you that way. So, yeah, click compression is important, but in terms of calling bluffs, yes, Desperado makes it easier, but even if you don't have that, calling bluffs is generally really important. Trying to manage the remotes that are in play, even if they're not agendas, knowing what those face-down cards are that the corp has in play is really, really important for runners. So, yeah, I'd recommend you to call bluffs, as Brian said, where you can avoid the danger. And one thing that's important and that you develop as you play more games and learn more about the card pool is that even though we were saying earlier that the card pool has expanded and there are more threats there are more things that a face down card in a server can masquerade as now than there was before, there are still only a limited number. And there's even smaller number that will actually harm you or do damage to you. And there's an even smaller number again that are within each faction. Run, check it. If it's an agenda, great, you steal it. If it's the thing that you thought it was or one of those things that you narrowed the possibilities down to, you take the hit, you recover, and you spend the rest of your clicks either removing the tag from the snare or drawing up again or whatever else. So if you do have the resources on the turn when they present you with that choice to make yourself immune to dying, to the range of threats that it could be, do it. And then once you get into more gray areas where you can't make yourself immune to every threat, it's really about calling your opponent or not. It's a judgment call based on their other behavior so far in the game, calling any tells that you might think they have, any other information you have about the state of the game. Are they doing this as a desperate act? Do they have no other way to win? Are they at match point and you have 0 points? You know, the state of the game is really important a lot of the time, and whether you call a bluff.
Like, if they're on 5 points, you want to have to call every server, right? Because any of them could be the game-winning agenda. The winning agenda.
There's also two different things that we've identified. There's player bluffs, and there are decision bluffs. And I think in general, the example that Brian gave us, I think we've all been there, and we've all lost games or won games in similar situations. But from my experience, it's best to treat your opponent as a decision-making automaton for the purposes of the game. So when we talk about bluffs, we're always reacting to decisions that the player has made and the reasons and the context behind those decisions. We're not really reacting to the sigh that the player made or slumped shoulders or anything, because that will differ from person to person and those are completely unreadable. So even though we've all been there, it's best to try and block that sort of thing out and always look at decisions and the reasoning behind them.
Our next question is from Paxton R. He writes, I've got an interesting topic for you. Anarch code gatebreakers. Criminals have gotten quite a few options to cover the same gap, while Anarchs are basically on plain Yogg or Bust. Is another Anarch decoder likely? What drawbacks do you expect on it? Jesse?
I think it's high time for Anarchs to get another decoder. Shapers have a range of killers that can fit into their decks that aren't as inefficient as Force of Nature. Killers are the weakest type for Shapers, and Decoders are the weakest type for Anarchs, and Fractors are the weakest type for Criminals. But even if Anarchs got some Decoders that were slightly more limited use, similar to the Dogs, although we note that the Dogs, the Cerberus cards, that is, the Cycler 3 Cerberus cards, are there to fill the second weakest breaker for each faction. If the Anarchs had a limited use breaker, which would certainly fit in with the Anarch themes of having temporary advantages and gaining things that aren't around forever, that would probably be something that would be interesting, because there is now a bit of a gap in what Anarchs are able to do in terms of interacting with a lot of the higher strength code gates we have now. Yogg is certainly not the auto-include powerhouse that it once was, due to in part things like Lotus Field, but also to the proliferation of 7 strength code gates in the big box, including Checkpoint and Wormhole. Anarch certainly does have other tools to deal with that. I know, Owen, you're pretty keen on AI breakers like Knight to deal with those situations. So, I mean, there are other ways to do that. I definitely think there's space for another decoder Anarchs, and I hope one comes soon.
Our next question comes from Sebastian Z, and he asks us about the concept of obscuring the game state through the use of custom counters or dice and so on. He wants us to discuss this because Netrunner still doesn't really have a judge program, and little misplays such as taking moves back, adding credits and tokens, and an out-of-order sequence are still hard to judge properly, as there's no strong guideline. I think we've all had experiences with players, whether purposefully or not, have obscured parts of the game, be it how many credits they have and so on. How do you think we can sort of deal with this as a community? Using dice for credits is not where you want to be.
Yeah, for credits in particular.
Yeah.
Like everything else, if you're going to count your Atman or count your Data Sucker, great, whatever. Because those kind of things, you know, you can look back over the past few turns and count those in relatively small numbers. But credits fluctuate so often that using something like a die or multiple dice that don't have any memory, that just roll from one position to another, it's just awful. You're just going to lose your game state and you're not going to be able to put it back together. The advantage to using credits is that you can pick them up and put them on one side of your mat, and then before you push them away into the massive pile of all your regionals winnings, agenda counters represent, you will actually be able to look back and show your opponent, look, there's my 3 credits for my Enigma. Or look, there's my 7 credits for my checkpoint
trace. And that's much easier for your opponent to remember. You know, it's much easier for an opponent to, when they're thinking back over the turn, find in their memory that action of your hand moving with the 3 credits in it and putting it over there. It's much easier for people's memories to remember that than to remember the one time you turned the dice, you know, or took that 3 dice away, or switched the dice around from a 5 to a 1.
Yeah, especially if you, like, compose dice together. So, like, I've seen some people have 2 D6s, and that will count a 1 through 6, or, like, they'll have a D6 and a D10, and then they'll, on one side they'll have a 1, and on the other side they'll have a 3 or whatever, and that will mean 13.
Not 4. I think it's very courteous when you sit down, particularly in a tournament setting, opposite your opponent, and you should really explain to your opponent what counters you're using. Like, for instance, you could just say, look, I use yellow credits and orange credits. They're 1s and 5s respectively. That's all you need to know. If you're using credit sticks or you're using counters for your memory, it's very important to make that clear to your opponent. If for some reason you're not putting your credits on your ID, but rather in one corner of your mat in the opposite corner to your bank, it's very important to make it clear to your opponent which corner is your bank and which is your actual credit pool. I think it's just really, really courteous for that kind of thing. Because if you're in the middle of the game, if you have to ask your opponent at any point how many credits they have, it can be a really big tell, and you don't really want to ask those questions sometimes, because if you say, oh, how many credits, and they could think, oh well, I'm playing criminal, he's probably thinking about whether he wants to account siphon, and I should, you know, ice up HQ a bit more next turn, you know, things like that. Would you guys agree?
Yeah, I think the number of credits in each player's credit pool is absolutely essential at every point in the game for both players to have easy access to. They shouldn't have to ask. They shouldn't have to clarify. You shouldn't stack credits. I mean, people who just have a giant pile of ones or have piles of ones, some of which are 6 and some of which are 3, even if you have piles of ones that are all in 5s, it can be really hard for your opponent to tell how many credits you have, particularly if you're not keeping those in immaculate conditions. So, you know, using larger denominations if you're playing a deck that has a tendency to accumulate huge piles of credits, or just simply keeping all your credits on one level so you're not stacking them, keeping them in a clear location, not obscuring them during your opponent's turn, so your opponent knows, you know, between each of their clicks exactly how many credits you have whenever they have to make a decision about how they're going to spend their click. All of that's really important. It's really courteous. And, you know, not doing that can really affect the fairness of the game.
Yeah, and I think that it's also really important to really, where you can, minimize the number of different tokens you use. Fair enough if you're playing a Corset NBN and you need to have 2 recurring credits on your ID, make sure that those tokens are vastly different to your credit tokens. But if you're using things like memory counters or, you know, the kind of click trackers that you move around the table a lot, you want to, I think, reduce to just one type of token. I don't think you want to try and confuse your opponent too much in any way, because whether you're doing it on purpose or not, it is sort of giving you an advantage in some cases.
Yeah, and like look, like even in Magic, where we have an immaculate judge program with massive rule books and massive IPG, and, you know, a hierarchy, you know, you could always appeal to a head judge or get help from other judges. The vast proportion of situations we come across as judges could simply be resolved if players talked a little bit more. if they asked questions of each other that weren't too leading, or if they just represented their information a little bit better, and helped each other maintain the game state from both sides of the table. So, like, when my opponent has a parasite, you know, it's okay for me to put that virus counter on in a casual game. Or if my opponent has forgotten to pay with their bad pub, it's okay for me to do that. Because the thing is, if they go and try and fix that back in time, it's going to make a mess. It's going to make a mess of the game state. We're going to have to work out how many credits were here, how many credits were there, where that was lost, how many runs were made. Too many questions, too much hassle. Both players can be responsible for maintaining that game state.
I think it's also important to note that I think it's really important that you stick to the zones that are designated in the rulebook when it comes to the layout of your play area. For instance, as a court player, you should be able to tell at a glance how many programs your opponent has versus how many pieces of hardware or resources they have. They should be separated. You shouldn't put your resources next to your programs, next to your hardware. And, you know, similarly, if you're playing a corp that has, you know, a lot of servers, and you say you res two pad campaigns, tell your opponent that you're going to put them on top of each other to save room. Don't just do it. You know, you want to communicate with your opponent about those kind of things.
Yeah, the less time they spend, you know, leaning over the table, squinting, scratching their head, and going, pointing around the table, wondering, Wilfie-esque. This is what Wilfie does all the time. You know, he'll lean right over and he'll start pointing at things wildly and going, what's this, what's this, what's this? I don't know, maybe he needs glasses. But the less time you can spend doing that, the better the game will be for both players, and the less likely we will need a judge program at some point that's as expansive and as deliberated and as frankly as infuriating as the Magic IPG.
Until someone tries to trap somebody in a double wormhole loop. I think a lot of it is just having respect for your opponent and just acting with a bit of dignity, especially to do with taking moves back and just being clear about what you're doing. You know, if you're in an official situation, think about your decisions and then make them. Be responsible for your triggers. If it's something simple like having a Desperado and a Corroder against an Ice Wall, you can sort of announce that you're going to go through the server for credit neutral. But if it's anything more complicated than that, just do it step by step. It takes like 1 second longer, and it just means you don't make mistakes, and it means that your opponent is completely up to speed with everything that has gone on during the encounter.
So they were essentially the finalists for our What Lies Ahead Data Pack competition. As we said, we did get quite a lot of emails, a lot of entries for this competition, and it was very hard to choose even five or six to discuss in one episode. But we're happy to announce that the winner is Paul L, who asked a question about managing information. We thought that question was very good and it generated some very good discussion. So Paul, keep your eyes on your email. We'll be sending you information soon about how we can get that data back to you. Other than that, we'll be back next week as normal. You can get in contact with us on Twitter at Winning Agenda. You can shoot us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com, or you can check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Until then, it's been great and we'll see you soon, guys. Bye.
Woohoo. Thanks, guys. Thanks to our special guest, Owen, for appearing on this episode, and we hope that his stunning form in the Netrunner scene continues unabated.
You can only get up, right?
We can only go up.
See you guys.